Hey, commuter, let's do some math. Grab a piece of paper and a pencil. Go on, I'll wait. Oh wait, you're driving, forget it. Just mentally do this. Okay, what do you get when you add Phil plus Peter plus Alex Shapiro and then subtract Chris? The answer? A pretty darn good show. Need some evidence? Check out this.
All right, tell me the dad joke. I'm ready.
All right, so Phil, you just want to let the listener know what you just mentioned. Well, it doesn't really matter. It does matter, but it doesn't. Anyway, how does the joke go? Now I'm on pressure. We got to, Chris, you got to edit this out. Guy goes to the doctor and says, "Doctor, I broke my arm in 4 places." And the doctor says, "Well, don't go to those places anymore."
Helpless. Beyond helpless.
On the day that I got my received information that I had finally been awarded my doctorate, I had started playing hockey again after the 4th broken arm. This was when I was like 30 or something like that. Four broken arms were when I was a kid. But the when I went back to play again in my 30s, that I got the doctorate, I went down to the ice rink to play with the Geezer League. And I walked in, it's like, finally got my doctorate today. Crickets, nothing. 20 seconds goes by and everybody's like, one guy looks at me and says, "All right, doc, can you fix what's wrong with my knee?" And I was like, "No."
Well, I'm not that kind of doctor. I'm not the kind of doctor that helps people. I'm just I'm a music doctor.
Absolutely.
If you have music problems, I can help you with that. Yeah, that's right.
Well, commuter, this is a different recording. We are minus, for the very first time in Beyond Artless history, we're minus Chris Gleason.
We are.
So our thoughts are with Chris right now. He's with his mama right now, and they're making sure that they take care of Chris's mama together. I would imagine that his brother Tim is there as well. What kind of help Tim is would be highly questionable.
Questionable. Hopefully he's wearing his t-shirt that we gave him, and there'll be a lot less sound effects in this one, so that's exciting. But my editing skills are not quite as good, so we'll have to figure that out too. Hopefully he'll still edit this one.
I thought, Peter, you were a master of self-editing.
Huh?
As you go.
Everybody who knows me knows that is not true. I'm not very good at choosing what exits my mouth or not until after I realized it was a bad choice.
I feel like over the years, though, you've improved, that your self-editing skills have...
Well, there was a long way to go, so it's easy to improve when you start as low as I did.
The sole exception to that would be in a faculty meeting, that your self-editing skills are gone.
I've gotten better at speaking less in faculty meetings. I that has happened post Eau Claire time.
So
they're a lot longer.
That's your desire for the meeting to be shorter.
Can't take it anymore, and then I have to say something. That's about right. So meetings are my favorite time of the day. In fact, we have one tomorrow morning, so that's exciting.
I do too. Well, but look, instead of paying attention to the meeting, we can text each other. It'll be great.
Oh my gosh, we'll be those kids in the back of class. I actually sat in and
we were all scolded. The entire faculty were scolded about a month ago for doing that during meetings.
With each other?
People were texting it was a big junior high experience.
I played euphonium last night. Kid was a couple rehearsals left before a concert, and a student was gone. So I sat in on some euphonium in our third concert band, and oh my God, I was that kid in the back of the room. Like, you just put a low brass instrument on my hand and I couldn't shut up. I was telling jokes. My students are up there trying to conduct and I've got the whole back row laughing. I'm so sorry. It happened. I don't know.
We're gonna abridge the banter.
That's a good idea.
The fact that we can get this under 4 minutes means that, a happy commuter listener.
That's right.
If we can sort of shrink that. So I would say that our guest that's coming on is a lover of all things in nature, and probably her connection with nature fuels her wonderful approach to music composition. I bet that this composer can see humpback whales from her house. I bet that this composer had a long 25-year career in TV and film music and then left it to go do something new. I think this person that we're about to meet is an award-winning photographer and a fabulous writer on all sorts of topics. And I have a feeling that this our guest lives on an island in Washington State, San Juan Island, to be specific. Sure. Peter, who is this?
Well, you had me at humpback whales. It's got to be none other than Alex Shapiro.
Yay! Welcome.
Well, you got to get better at writing this. It's just really obvious. Anyway, I'm just kidding.
Wow.
That's great. So, usually we have, sorry, Alex, usually we also have things that we don't necessarily know about the composer. Is there anything you'd like to share about your history that's like a unique thing about you?
Well, I have to remain a woman of mystery to some degree. However, there is probably something that most people don't know about me, even although if they've read my bio and read in the fine print, they might have noticed this. Many years ago, I used to breed pythons. I had a really large collection of reptiles, mostly snakes, a few frogs, a few lizards, even a legless lizard, which is actually more like a snake. But, well, it's sort of a combo platter of lizard and snake. They have eyelids, which makes them a lizard, but they have no legs, which makes them rather snake-like. But I digress. At any rate, I bred pythons, among other things. I had about 60 snakes at one point in a lot of different terrariums. I had a pretty large place. This was back in Los Angeles. And so that is something that I think a lot of people don't know about me. My biggest snake, not that size matters, but in this case, my biggest snake was 19 feet long. She was a Burmese python, and she was as big around as I am. I mean, I'm not that large, but I'm a small, compact person. But she was a very large, non-compact snake. So, you know, we evened out. So
you couldn't pick her up.
No, it would take three people to pick her up. I have pictures somewhere of three of us holding her, and she had a very, very large enclosure, and she was great. She was.
I have a lot of questions. Were the frogs to feed the snakes?
No, no, no. That was other wildlife. We won't even go there because then everybody will be so appalled.
Peter will be upset. But
people who've done this, they know the drill. But those who haven't, who are used to just having dogs and cats, who by the way are not exactly vegetarians, right? It's all in a neat little can, and so you don't think about it. Whereas with snakes, it's on the hoof, so to speak. I mean, you know, you're not opening cans of snake food. Purina's finest python food. They don't make it.
You can't tell me now, but maybe we can put it in the chat. But what do you feed a 19-foot snake that's like a foot around? But you can't tell.
Anything she wants.
Yeah, that's right.
I think that's the punchline right there. Or I should say anybody she wants.
Right.
I mean, people would be my friend just so that I wouldn't feed them to the snake. I think that's how I made friends, is under threat. That they figured, well, if I'm not nice to her, I'm off to the garage to be with the snake. No, she ate full grown chickens and rabbits.
What's up, Dad?
So, wow. Yeah, they're constrictors, so it was a lot, and rats. Although mostly the smaller pythons ate rats and snakes, and rabbits. But she ate she liked chickens a lot.
Clearly, I mean, we're going to come back to this later in the podcast because
and I've just deleted half my questions to be nice because I don't want a python to show up.
No, you're in luck. I only have a spotted leopard gecko right now and two cats. Okay. But you're safe. The gecko is only, you know, about 8 inches, 10 inches long. So you're safe. I can't threaten you or torture you with the gecko. It would be too cute.
Calmer.
They look like little cartoon characters. So.
Kind of like an insurance salesman.
Yes, exactly. And it speaks in an accent and everything.
This has gone swimmingly.
This has gone sideways quickly. Yes.
I love it. Yeah. This is like the banter that we don't get with Chris. Now we just have it with you. I love it.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll come back. Gosh, all the snakes must have stayed in L.A.
They did stay in L.A. I was really into the amateur herpetology for about 10 years. In the 80s into the early 90s. And then I slowly divested myself of, all the many different snakes. I was a very active member of the American Herpetological Society. That's the kind of geek
awesome.
I am. I go whole hog, so to speak, into these things. So it wasn't hard to find people who would take on and adopt my babies, my scale babies. But that was quite a time. It was really fun. And the great thing, I just have to put in one final plug for having reptiles, especially if you're a musician or especially a composer where you actually need to concentrate. Reptiles make no sound. They really don't.
That's right.
They're a great pet to have. There's no barking. There's no mewling. There's no interruption. They're just nice and quiet. So folks, if you are a composer, I highly recommend snakes. Great pets. And you don't have to feed them every day.
That's right. Yeah. Unlike Phil.
Oh, that's true. Peter, there are more questions. We'll come back to it later. We'll have snake Q&A. Don't worry. It's coming back.
Don't panic. Snake jokes.
Q&A. You don't hear that on every music podcast.
No. Not really. Alex, I have to say how awesome your second symphony is and how much I enjoyed the performance of the piece that you did with the Eau Claire Wind Symphony.
Thank you. That means a great deal to me because I think that's my best piece so far. So thank you so much for saying that. That's like my favorite piece now. So
tell me what has elevated that piece into that sort of stratosphere right now, being your favorite piece. Why is it that way?
I think because I got over those four movements, and each movement is really contrasting and really different in style, even though it's cohesive under the form of a classical symphony. I followed the form really quite specifically for fun. But each movement I get to express a different part of myself in each movement, and I get to say something that I really wanted to say. There was nobody was telling me what to say or anything. There was no guidance of, we want you to write a piece about, such and such snakes. No, nobody said anything. So I wrote it right during the pandemic, which for all of us, boy, did we need catharsis going through what we were going through and not knowing how long all that quarantining was going to last and not knowing how the virus was going to continue to proceed. And there were a lot of unknowable things. And the one thing great about composing is, it's great if you're a control freak. Composing is a great profession for control freaks because you are absolutely in control of every little black dot, every articulation, the vast form of the piece that you're doing, whatever it is, the style, all of the choices are yours. People can mangle it after the fact if they want, and sometimes they do. Not Eau Claire. That was lovely. That was a wonderful performance. But it's really rewarding. So I think that's why the piece is my favorite, because it goes a lot of places. It says a lot of different things. And I think for me, we're always holding ourselves up to a reasonably high personal standard of excellence. We can't say, who cares what other people think? If I thought about that, I'd never write another note. But if I'm holding myself up to my own personal, standard, I felt like I came kind of close in parts of that piece.
The self-expressive part of the piece is fantastic. I love the story that's attached to it, and I love all the movements. They were all equally fascinating to me. Is there a part of the piece or that turned out differently than you were expecting, or did it all sound like you heard it in your head?
It did sound like I heard in my head, but the part that turned out differently was the first movement, Airborne, which is of the four movements, it's the only purely acoustic one. And to be honest, it turned out better than I thought it would because I wrote it, I knew what I was hearing in my head, and I wasn't convinced that it could be played at the tempo I want. And I worked very hard on the mallet parts to make them, playable and all that. I mean, I really tried to make it work, and also for the woodwinds too, especially the clarinets. There was a lot of, broken chords, arpeggios, things that you couldn't repeat endlessly unless you orchestrated it right. And I was afraid that maybe I was going to miss the mark, but I was happily surprised. And I asked people for feedback all the time. Anytime there's a new piece, I'm always wanting to hear from the musicians. Hey, did I screw up? Did I write you something that's not playable or that doesn't sit well? Like maybe it's playable, but you're having to work too hard for that, right? I really care a lot about the musicians and their experience with the piece. So I was really pleasantly surprised that after the thought I put into it seemed to work out, because so far I have not gotten, you know, hate mail or anything like that. So that's always a good sign.
It's curious to me that when I have conducted other pieces that you've written, when I've heard them in the audience, when I look at your writings, when I look at people that interview you, it seems impossible to me that you would ever be worried or have fear attached to any element of your music. You appear courageous and fearless to us. So
that's
it's curious.
So sweet.
Well, but
I'm curled up in a fetal position here in the studio on a nightly basis. Believe me, like right now I'm working on another EA band piece and the middle section is like killing me. I can't get it right. You know, I still haven't gotten it right. So you're sweet to say that. Thank you.
Well, you're welcome. But it makes you human yes. to be that way. And you're like yeah. the rest of us, which is really great. I think as performer anyway, we're all nervous that we're not attaching to the work the way that the composer had in their mind, that we're, yeah. there's something we're doing as a performer that we're going to prevent the realized performance from coming together the way the composer intended. At least I worry about that as a performer and certainly as a conductor.
Yeah.
Like it's a terror that I'll get in the way of that. How do you handle that with conductors?
Like, very kindly, because, you know, think of it this way, that music, whatever the piece is, even if it's a little 4-minute ditty, it's been swirling around, you know, on the gerbil wheel in my head for a really long time as I've been working on it and writing it and doing the music prep and all that stuff. Whereas the conductor is combing through it, reading it, studying it for the first time. And even by the time they and their musicians premiere it or play it, even if it's not a premiere, they still have only lived with the music a relatively very short time. And in that short time, with X number of never enough rehearsals, you know, they've had to absorb to their best ability what the composer's intent might have been. This becomes a little easier when the composer is still looking at the daisies from this side of the lawn, because you can bring us in for Zooms. You know, we can really bring the piece alive, I think. I did this earlier today. I do it all the time, you know, with ensembles. Yeah. When they hear from the person responsible for the notes on their stand, I think it does help the music come alive when they understand what her or his impetus was. Why are those notes there? What do they mean? But I really think that composers need to always keep in mind that it's brand new, even if it's a piece that's older. If someone hasn't conducted it or played it before, it's brand new to them, and it does take time to really absorb into one's DNA. I mean, don't you feel this way? Both of you, you know, about repertoire. I mean, I'm talking like classical repertoire. For me, you know, as a pianist, if I pick up a Beethoven sonata that I haven't played before, or maybe it's one of the ones I haven't listened to a lot or something, I mean, you can put any example there. But even though it's old repertoire, it's new to me, and it takes me a while to really sink into it and understand how I want to play it. You know, it takes a while.
Absolutely. I mean, I do my best to digest as much of the intro to all the music for the whole next year in the summer when I have time, because then it can just gestate for months, even though I'm coming back to it maybe after a couple of different concert cycles. It's been back there doing things so that it helps me be more prepared with my students. Alex, can you talk about your compositional process a little bit? I know this could be a dissertation or a five-part series, but just quickly, like, I'm always interested.
Yeah, 20 seconds or less.
You know, 20 seconds or less, exactly. Yeah.
But and maybe just even a little bit electroacoustic music is what I've definitely known you to be part of your voice, and maybe like how you came to that. But I think you were writing a long time before you were adding electroacoustic, so kind of like your process, but then how that moved into electroacoustic would be.
Yeah, it actually came. Well, it came from having a project studio working in commercial media for so many years before I switched over to concert music. And then when I had that, I always had state of the art stuff. I'm always the geek person. I mean, since I was a kid, I was the kid, you know, who could plug in and set up anybody's parents' stereo. I always just give me cables, give me wires. I know what to do. And I didn't electrocute myself or anybody else yet process. Yet is the operative word. But I was always driven and interested in electronics from the 1970s. Because remember, I'm almost 62 years old. So I got to work with synthesizers when I was 15 years old and build my own and all that. It was really fun. So that kind of morphed into commercial music. And then when I changed my career into, at the time, chamber music in my late 30s and concert music, all of a sudden, in addition to writing mostly acoustic pieces, chamber works, I had a number of musicians asking me for electroacoustic pieces, mostly solo pieces, because they knew I had this rig and right. they thought it would be kind of fun. And then when I got many years later, 10 years after that, out of the blue into the band world, and by this time I was, in my mid to late 40s, but my first band piece, I'd never even been to a band concert. I knew nothing about bands.
Neither did not is
know
Phil.
Which we just lost him on that one. And who can blame yep. him for saying, I'm out of here,
right.
you know?
That's right. He'll be back. I'm sure he'll be back.
But I realized very quickly that, especially after I went to the Midwest Clinic for the first time, after doing one band piece for the U.S. Army, and I went to the Midwest Clinic and I was surrounded by all that amazing music. And my first thought was, oh my God, this is ridiculous. I'm never going to sound like this. I can never do this. This is not what I sound like. And then I snapped out of it. And my second thought was, wait a minute, I don't have to sound like any of that. Those guys, and it was mostly guys back then, 13 years ago, those guys have it covered. You know, they're doing them. That's excellent. And so that forced me to look at myself and ask myself, okay, what do I bring to the table? What do I have to say in this genre? Because I really loved the medium. I thought wind band, I mean, I still do, 26 pieces later, I think it's the coolest thing in the world. Because, I mean, that wall of sound coming at you, plus the delicacy that you can create, all the timbres, everything about it I love, and the enthusiasm of the conductors and the players.
Eager.
And so that's how I came to electronics in band music. I mean, I've written out of the 26 pieces, three of them are acoustic, but acoustic only and no track. But really, I figured, you know, my niche and my voice and something I can give to the repertoire in band is different than what the majority of people are doing. So, and even for those of us like my friend Stephen Bryant and many others, you know, who are doing electroacoustic pieces, they don't do quite as many of them as I do. But even the ones, you know, they're doing it a fair amount. We all sound different from each other. The same way that anybody, you know, if everybody's writing viola sonatas, all those pieces are going to sound different, right? So we're not, nobody's in competition with anybody. Everybody's got their own sound, their own sound.
Yeah, and I love how I was at one of the Midwest clinics you did with Pete Ginther and Craig Kirchhoff was quite a while ago, maybe Jerry too.
Yeah, that's right.
But
on EA Music, yeah.
Yeah, and it was really nice. I mean, I guess it was the first time I'd heard it said this way. It really made me think, you're like, this is just another section in the band, right? There's woodwinds, brass, percussion, there's electroacoustics. And that really helped inform not only how I read it study it and prepare it, but just how that voice is mixed in with everything else, which was really helpful.
That's great to hear, because that I do say that often, because I think that's a very good grounding point, especially for conductors in terms of finding the balance and what is the purpose of the track. You know, it's not just an accompaniment track at all, in my case,
extra.
Almost never. It's not extra. It wasn't written afterwards. You know, like sometimes a lot of the students will say, which comes first, you know, the instruments or the track? And I say, no, it's all written absolutely, you know, simultaneously, just as I would any large ensemble piece. You know, you're writing all the instruments at the same time, back, forth. But that's just it. The reason for me, I can't speak for my colleagues who write electroacoustic pieces, but for me, the whole reason is to create sounds that I can't get from the other sections in the ensemble, whatever the ensemble is, orchestra, band, anything, kazoo choir, I don't know, whatever it's going to be, I want to come up with complementary frequencies and textures and whatever those are going to be. So I'm never emulating any of the instruments that are in my live ensemble. And it really is an additional, separate, and equal section of every ensemble. Yeah.
Welcome back, Phil. You decided to join us again.
Yeah.
I don't blame you for leaving, really.
No, it was not a purposeful thing. Apparently, all my various children who are probably video gaming their brains out probably knocked out my internet for a moment. This will be a bit of a diversion, because I bet you Peter has more follow-up questions about that. But I was wondering if we can go back a little further, maybe to some of your childhood, which I believe was in New York City. Is that true?
Yeah, Manhattan.
That had to fuel some of your interest in all sorts of things.
Hugely.
from music to activism to you name it. But I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about growing up there and what it was like.
Yeah, it was amazing, especially in the 70s, because that was really, for those of you who don't know, it was a particularly gritty time in the city, really gritty. And Times Square looked totally different at the time. So did much of the West Side. So did a lot of the city looked really different than people, you know, think of it as being now. And it was an amazing place to grow up if you were a young artist, because everything and anything was going on and available. And, you know, I was really lucky to have, I'm an only child of two parents who loved the arts. And really, I was sort of the third adult in the house from the time I, you know, arrived. And they were not really into the child and parenting thing per se. And that was actually great for me because they gave me the run of the city at a very young age to just do what I wanted to do and go check out whatever I wanted. And at the time, you know, clubs weren't carding. It was a different world. You know, you could, as long as you were cool, you could just go anywhere. So here I am, 13, 14 years old, hanging out at the Village Vanguard and Sweet Basil and, you know, these amazing clubs, and going to the Met Opera and going to the Joffrey and Alvin Ailey Ballet and going to musicals on Broadway. And and the way I was able to afford this, because it was so much cheaper at the time, I was babysitting. I think my top fee was $1.25 an hour. And that was great. That's all I needed, because a standing room ticket at the Met Opera was $3. And because I was, of course, always going by myself, because really how many other eighth graders really do want to go see Wozzeck? I don't know, but not that many. And so I would invariably get an orchestra seat by the second act. You know, I would just lean on the rail and scope everything out, and boom, I did the same thing for all the Broadway shows. You know, I did this for everything. So, you know, I'd dress nicely, I'd buy a standing room ticket, and I'd always be able to second act. And it was a good technique. It worked. And, but again, you know, things were affordable then. The Village Vanguard at the time, it cost me $5 to get in. And
so
maybe
you're saying
beer.
I should babysit.
You
if
should
I
babysit.
Need a little extra
Everybody
money.
Should babysit.
Phil,
and you know what?
Down.
From what I hear, babysitters make a lot more money now than we did in the 70s.
This is also true.
But so, man, yeah. that was my ticket. And I don't know if my parents actually cared if I came home or not, but literally they would say, my father in particular, who did love me, he was great, but he would say, where it would be like a Wednesday night, and I'd say, you know, I want to go check out Michael Brecker or Elvin Jones or whoever, you know, down at the club. Yeah. And he'd say, okay, when are you going to be back? And I'd back time it. This was where I learned the art of back timing, folks, which is a very necessary thing for any composer on deadlines. I would back time how long it would take me to come back from all the way downtown, and, you know, how long I'd have to wait for the train at midnight and this and that and the other. And I would just say, okay, 1 o'clock. You know, 1 a.m. And he'd say, fine, be home by 1 a.m. And that was a really great contract he made with me, because basically I'm a firm believer, and I have no children, so this had never been tested. I have cats, and, you know, so I can't be trusted with children, and you're about to find out why. I am a firm believer that if you give an intelligent child responsibility, they want to please you and they want to live up to your view of them. If you've been great enough to give them a shot, if the child is smart, and I was reasonably clever, I realized, don't mess this up. Come home when you say you're going to come home, and then you can keep going out. And that's how it worked in my household. I think there was only one time that I was late, and my father was not happy, and I did not want to displease my father because I loved him. So I had this magical time. I was telling the students, I think today that I was Zooming with, I was telling them about how in the 70s, and you guys know this, we had, there were two things at the same time coming up new at the same time, disco and punk. And, you know, to be able to go to both kinds of clubs, yeah, sometimes in the same night, although wardrobe changes might be necessary in certain ways. You know, you wouldn't wear the same thing to Studio 54 that you would wear to CBGB. But nonetheless, the fact that, you know, your head would just explode with all the cool new stuff, or even goofy. I mean, I wasn't a big disco fan even at the time. But still, it was new. It was the thing. That and the smell of polyester and big shoulder pads and all of that glitter and sequin.
Okay, so I have to go back a little bit. New York makes I didn't know about New York, actually. That's really interesting. Yeah. And then that gets you to L.A. You have a huge love of nature, and you live in one of the most beautiful. I had a chance to teach at Mercer Island High School out in Seattle area. So I love the San Juan Islands, Anacortes, all that. And how did you find your love for that? Because when I think of LA and New York, I don't think of living next to the humpback whales and as much.
That was absolute luck. But there is a progression, I think, in it. Because when I was 16, I was accepted as the youngest composer, I think, at the Aspen Music School and Festival in beautiful Aspen. And so that was the very first summer. It was a seminal summer for me. And so was the next one. I went there two summers, 16 and 17. So this was 78 and 79, if we're keeping score. And that was the first time that I had lived basically as an adult, you know, I was on my own for two solid months in a beautiful, completely, you know, nature surrounded, yeah, nature-based environment. And it blew my mind because it was the first time that everything was kind of coming together. I was steeped in music, having an amazing time at the school and doing everything under the sun imaginable. And doing it surrounded by nature and going hiking and whitewater rafting and all these things in between, you know, all of my classes and performances and stuff. And I think that that was, and plus it was, you know, a coming of age time, right? So all of that together was really powerful. It was such a positive experience. And then even though I ended up moving a few years later to Los Angeles to work, I would always seek out nature in LA, and I kept moving to more and more nature-oriented places. The first 10 years of my 24 years in LA, the first 10 years I was in the very uninspired San Fernando Valley. I mean, it has its hype. It has nice places, but not where I was living.
Right.
And then I moved out for the last 15 years that I was in LA. I was living at the sea in Malibu. And I also had a sailboat up in Santa Barbara as well. So I was living as much in nature as one can, even though I was in LA proper,
sure,
and working in the city. And then it became sort of a no-brainer. At a certain point, I felt like I had done everything I wanted to do in LA, and it was time for a change. And then I just happened to run into somebody who knew this area, which I had never heard of. I never heard of the San Juan Islands. And she said, oh, come on up and visit. You're going to love this. And the rest is history. And that was almost 17 years ago.
Now. Wow.
So, yeah. So that's my triangulation. But sometimes you find nature or whatever the thing is that makes you happy in an oblique way. It doesn't, it's not like, you know, you seek it out. It's more like it just happens and you realize how happy it makes you. And I'm a big believer for all of us that when you are surrounded with whatever it is that makes you happy. And for some people, that is a big city. And for other people, it's the suburbs, whatever the thing is, do that. What you look out at the window at is a very key component, I think, of your happiness.
Alex, you were mentioning earlier that you were Zooming with some students earlier. And this is obviously something that you do with regularity, if not every day, it's, you know, probably every other.
Yeah.
I saw in that capacity to Eau Claire when you did it, and it was just fabulous. I was wondering if in the course of all those Zooms and meetings that you've had, if there's ever been a time where a student just totally floored you with what they said and just set you back on your heels, either in a good way or a challenging way, or just because children can say things that are just they perceive things a lot more than we expect they do sometimes. And I'm wondering if you could share a story like that.
Oh, man, that is such a great question. And I wish I had a great story, but it's absolutely true. There have been times when I've been a little taken aback, and usually in a good way. One of the funnier things I had recently, it wasn't a Zoom in a class. It was a Zoom with somebody who's doing a dissertation on either me or biography. I don't know what he's writing something, which is very flattering. And he said to me, he's a graduate student someplace. And I forget which university. And this is recent. This happened last week. And this floored me. He said, I did an outline. I went onto your website, you know, and I did an outline of all the things about you that I want to address in my paper or whatever. And I nodded. And he said, and I gave it to my, I'm not in academia, what do you call the supervising teacher for a dissertation? There's probably a term.
Mentor.
Yeah, he gave it to his mentor. And she immediately said to him, well, you obviously put together the bios of three different people here, and this person doesn't exist. I think you got mixed up. And he looked at her and he said, no, this is just the one person. And she said, I don't believe you. And he gave her the link to my website. And she had to come. She read my bio and she came back and she said, oh, yeah, this is a little unusual. And I thought that was the funniest thing, that she that literally she didn't believe that I existed. And I thought that's probably a good thing.
You are that impressive. I mean, most, yeah, you are impressive. So, most people haven't lived the three lives you've lived. That's true.
But I want to talk about that because your website is awesome.
There's a lot on your website.
There's way too much on it. I don't know
how to edit. It's great. Well, I think it shows that you're willing to share and you're honest and you're open and you're genuine. So, and I think, you know, as much as we can gather that, this is meeting you is way more, it shows us even more of that. But I think your website shows that. But I would venture to say that a lot of your career now hinges, not necessarily on your website, but your ability to harness the power of the internet, I guess, to work for you. So I'm wondering.
Phil, welcome to 2001. I'm so excited you've joined
the
us.
Power in the of the internet.
Well, clearly, tonight I've been using my dial up, so it's not working very well. I was wondering, I know you could probably talk about it for the next 35 minutes, but you have strong feelings about it, about how an artist can has to interact with the internet and with, I guess, their website. But I wonder if you'd talk about it for a minute.
Sure. And that's exactly how I was able to move up to this little rock in the middle of nowhere. We have no bridge. This is really remote. There are, 6,000 people full-time on this island. The island itself is twice the size of Manhattan. It's 55 square miles. So we have a lot of room. And it is all because of technology that artists in general, not just me, but any artist can, if they're not a performer. I mean, if you're a performer, sure, you'll just be on a whole lot of planes getting off the island. But let's say if you are a composer or a painter or, you know, a writer or somebody who doesn't have to be with people every day to do what you do, it's phenomenal what technology has given us. It's given us freedom and often financial freedom because it's very expensive to live in cities. And many artists feel like they need to be in cities in order to get their career going. And I don't disagree with that. I think it would have been a mistake for me to move to San Juan Island when I was 28. You know, I think there's a reason to be, you know, build your relationships and your experiences with other human beings. But at a certain point, if you can use all of that to have established yourself, and as I did, because I was just silly lucky that at the start of my concert music career was also the start of when the internet really took off for artists. It was in the late 90s. And I, being the geek I am, I programmed my own website from the very beginning on all of that. I learned how to code, just taught myself how to do this stuff because I figured this will be useful. And I learned how to do interactive stuff like MP3s, believe it or not, were a really big deal back 25 years ago. Being able to put
I'll
an MP3.
I'll tell you what that is later. It'll be good.
And so getting a streaming thing.
Mezzo piano. That's
three of them.
Okay, sorry. Three mezzo piano. Got it.
MP3. That's very funny. I'm going to steal that. So I wouldn't have been able to be up here if it weren't for the internet, because I had put my career very much online from the very beginning. And so really quickly, within the first couple of years, I was getting a lot of international performances of the chamber music. And so it dawned on me at a certain point, once I had some traction, wow, I can live anywhere I want. I don't have to deal with the traffic of LA and the insanity and neuroses of a lot of the people there. And, I realized the freedom that I had. And also, it was a lot less expensive to, you know, to live elsewhere, to live in a rural area. So not everybody has this freedom, because, you know, some people actually have careers where they actually have to be with human beings. But I'm basically, as you can tell, you know, a misanthrope. I hate people. I don't want to be anywhere near them. I don't want to have to bathe, you know. I just want to hole up in the studio with my jar of peanut butter and be left alone. So, because you can tell with a non-social person I am. So
it's evident.
Works kinda out like really Phil. Well.
Yeah. But you have to enjoy when a piece of music is being premiered, one of your pieces of music being premiered. Do you like to be there in person if you can?
If I can, yeah. Often I'm not. Right. I certainly was for Suspended, because that was a, you know, residence. Usually a lot of the bigger premieres are residencies, and that's a joy. Right. That's a real joy. Free, right. at University of Wisconsin-Whitewater last year. That was a residency too for free.
Right.
That is, it's always so much fun to do it in person. Yeah.
Yeah.
Zoom is a far cry from being in person, obviously. Sure. I'm a big believer that mammals vibrate with each other. We have pheromones and vibrations and mammalian instincts that we want to be in tribes with each other. That's what we do. We're community-based creatures. And so it is an anomaly. I think it's rather odd, you know, to be two-dimensional when we're really three-dimensional.
Don't you think video, though, has come a long way? I mean, I don't know. Like, I feel like I get more interaction. It's not as good as being in the room, of course, but yeah. Phil does smell. So that's important to remember. He's often hiding in his closet.
Alex and I do have that in common. Clearly, it's a bathing optional situation. Yeah. Okay. Yeah,
but,
that's true.
I think the video, and I'm stealing this a little bit because we talked about this before you earlier, but you worked with Chris on rock music, Chris Gleason. He premiered rock music with his kiddos. Were you able to be in residency with them as well?
No, unfortunately, they didn't fly me out for that, but I did Zoom with them a couple of times, I think. And that was such a positive experience because, you know, Chris is awesome. And I'm not just saying that because this is his show too.
See, he's going to put applause with that or something.
He put in applause now. And he sent me a lot of money, you know, ahead of time, hoping I would make a plug. And I did. So, hey, Chris, pay up. But we had such a good time.
Don't really. You're going to pay for that later in some way, shape, or form.
Someone's going to pay.
Heads are going to roll. But I felt like I was there very much in spirit working with the students on that. It was very interactive. I literally engaged and involved the students in the making of the track.
Right.
Yeah.
Because I wanted them to go out and look for rocks that they were going to play. And I told them to record all their rock sounds and send them to me. So Chris sends me 106 or 7 MP3s of rocks. And so I proceed to, you know, organize them. And almost all of them ended up in the track as part of the texture of the track. And I thought that was really cool to give these students some agency. Like they can forevermore, this piece, which is done all over the place, they can say, that's my rock sound right there. That's me. So, you know, it was such a great experience doing that. And that is, even though I wasn't there in person, that was a premiere that I remember very, very well because they really went above and beyond. Chris brought in the pieces about climate change and geology and what have you. And it's a very minimalist. It's like the only band piece that has no melody and no rhythm. None. It's just texture. And I was so blown away by two things that Chris and his students did. It had nothing to do with my suggestion, which is first, Chris decided to bring in a geologist from one of the local universities to come into the band room and talk to the students about the very place that they live. How cool is that from a geological standpoint? And then one of Chris's students, and I remember her name happened to be Alexandra, I remember this, she put together this really great video of slideshow video thing of her own. And she nailed the ending where there's this horrific kind of climax of incredibly intentionally very, very ugly chord. She nailed that moment with the video of a glacier calving, you know, and crashing into the sea. And it's like, wow, that's powerful, you know, to get kids to feel, and these were middle schoolers, to get them to feel connected to a piece on an activist level like that, just through music.
As much as it hurts me to say it, Chris is really amazing. And he does go above and beyond all the time. And he engages his students in that depth of lifelong learning just because it's interesting rather than feeling like, you know, they have to do an assignment, right? Even that video is just show me that you understand the form of this piece. Then they get to do whatever they want. Yeah, he's a good guy.
So you were mentioning the tribe of mammals instinct that we all have. And I'm wondering, as you look out your front window there, which of those animals and or mammals are your favorites? Do you have favorite?
I think the otter family is my favorites because they're hilarious. They're like cartoon characters. We have 7 otters, a family that lives at the foot of the house. And fortunately for us and anybody who has otters, as you know, knows this, they stink to high heaven because they eat fish and whatever. And sometimes they get under people's houses and cause a lot of problem. But they don't get under our house, fortunately. So I love the otters, but I love, I mean, there's literally the great blue herons are amazing because they're so prehistoric. Mm-hmm. The bald eagles are massive and back and forth all the time. And obviously the whales, just yesterday, I was going to post this today on Facebook and I didn't have a chance, but just yesterday, three orcas came unbelievably close to the house. One of them was so close, I thought it was going to like knock on the door and ask for like a cup of sugar or something, you know, or do you have any salmon? You know, I really was, they were unbelievably close. And it's just, and it never gets old. I mean, I've lived here all these years and there's never a moment when I don't drop everything I'm doing and just pick up my camera and start shooting and just rig.
Have you had any close calls in a kayak?
Not yet. And I keep hoping to, because I mean, really, they're not going to do anything bad. You know, they really don't upend kayaks.
No.
And some of my friends have definitely, Dan and I love to kayak. Some of my friends have had experiences where they're much closer to the whales, but I haven't yet. I feel the same way about alien abduction. I feel like I'm the person that they should take, you know. I don't want any probing experiments.
It's me.
No probing. But clearly, take me. I'd like the adventure, you know. I'd be game for that. As long as they return me and nothing hurts.
Oh my God, you know,
I'm a wuss. I don't want to have any painful experiments. But I'm waiting for that encounter.
All right, first snake joke. Why are snakes so hard to fool?
Why?
They have no legs to pull.
A dad joke.
Oh yeah. I'm only in on
dad
jokes.
You're looking at two of them.
Nothing that's really funny. What does a snake? How does a snake shoot something?
How?
With a boa and arrow.
Oh God.
Well. It's going.
We left
really
speechless with that one.
Yeah,
really, really.
It's going really well, isn't it?
Well,
I have 47 more if you need.
Really? And if things slow down with this conversation, we're going to hear 45 of them.
Yeah,
at least,
just cue me. I'll be ready to go.
I have to say though, you did bookend the snakes pretty well, Peter. Though that's nice work.
Thank you.
Just bring
you.
It back. You
nice
promised
to
me you would.
Slither
you did
that one in there.
Yeah, he slithered
it. Nice. That was just. Hysterical. I loved it. Nice work.
So, Alex, you have obviously made a career out of adapting in a million different ways. And I'm wondering if you could look into the future 1 year, 5 years, 10 years, can you predict where the next adaptations are going to have to happen for composers in general or for you?
Well, for me, absolutely not, because that would ruin all the fun, right? We have no idea what we're doing. But I will say this regarding tech, because I do love keeping up with what's going on. Because every time somebody talks about the future when they see something, I'm like, no, this is the present. It's just you don't happen to be using it, but it's all here right now. And I think that AI and immersive experiences in virtual and augmented realities are going to be the next thing that composers and performers are going to benefit and audiences are going to benefit hugely from. I think that it's long overdue in a sense to be able, but it requires a lot of tech catch up, not mustard and ketchup, but catching up.
There's a dad joke there. Give me some tech.
A lot of tech to make the immersive thing happen. Even if it just means having, you know, everybody in an audience have headsets or, you know, speakers all around or screens, you know, kind of like, you know, the Sphere in Vegas or whatever. But I think that's where we're headed. The only thing holding it back is literally logistics, because the tech already exists. And so it's a money issue for a lot of places. But it is going to happen. And I think for those of us who are music makers, it's going to be amazing, because it's a truly immersive art form to be able to have people kind of really almost physically feeling an experience, not just having the music wash over them the way we do now at a concert, but really being part of it and a greater use of visuals, of course, and some amount of physical things. Maybe even, I mean, smell is a tricky one, because smell can be offensive really quickly to people. There's a reason, you know, back in the 1950s, smell-o-vision and scratch and sniff cards at movies and things like that were temporarily, you know, briefly a thing, and then it never really took off. And I always wonder about that. And I mean, I think, listen, there are a lot of times when we don't want to smell the things around us or the people around us. So I'm very grateful that Zoom does not have a smell feature.
Yeah, yeah. I am too. I Zoom with Phil a lot, so that's really helpful.
Yeah, our friendship seems to have blossomed, apparently.
Yeah, now that we're distant, just virtual friends, it's much better. Much better.
It's much better. Yeah. You don't have to bathe. It's awesome. No, you don't even have to wear pants. There's no proof that any of the three of us actually have legs, for that matter. I mean, we're just, you know, heads, torsos. That's it. You have no idea what's going on down there. But
I do love that idea, by the way, that the immersive experience. I really do. I mean, yeah. We've talked about this in the past and work with Bud Beyer and others that have really encouraged us to get our audiences engaged almost. I don't mean theater in the way of like schlocky, not great art, but every time there's a video component or a new audio experience or the group sings, right? There's a new timbre. We memorize or stand or move. The audience, almost always, it's their favorite piece. And I honestly think it's just because it's the first time they haven't passively been sitting there, but they're actually engaging with the art that's happening.
Yeah.
Like you have to do with theater, with movies, you know, things of that nature. And you're right. It's going to be, it's not only written in, it's going to get easier and easier and easier and more ubiquitous.
So you're already starting.
And you just articulated so beautifully, you know, the impetus behind some of my pieces like Lights Out and others, you know, that you know how driven I am to all this because, I mean, not for every piece, right? Some pieces you do want the audience to just absorb it and not have to do something. But I really think that for a long time, we've all kind of missed the boat. Certainly, what I'm always saying is that people are looking at screens all the time. Like we're looking at a screen right now. We're always looking at our phones, our computers, our media centers, you know, when we're watching movies and TV and all that. And the audiences are not the same audiences of 40 years ago. The audiences now, their brains are hardwired differently. Kids who have been on iPads since they are 2 years old, their brains are hardwired differently than ours even. And the people are used to swiping and moving and clicking and interacting and controlling. We're back to control. It's not just the composer controlling things. A lot of people would like to have a non-passive experience. And sometimes I think they've gotten so inured by a lot of things because of all the input constantly that it's almost like for us as entertainers, because we are entertainers, for us as entertainers to engage them takes more. Not in every case. I'm not making a sweeping statement, but I'm saying often that little thing, like have you all know, like as you're saying, Peter, when people just light up one LED light on stage, the whole audience goes, ooh.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it costs all of 25 cents, you know, that's it, that kind of thing. People are so, in a sense, starved for multimedia experiences in a venue.
Yeah.
Because that's really their whole daily life at this point is multimedia and just even the beginning, because most people don't have, you know, VR headsets and all that. But soon they will. And soon everybody will be wearing, you know, Google Glass was a great prototype and they'll be having something like that. So
that's going to come back like the QR code came back. Like once that gets figured out and we're already used to integrating our watches and everything else, it's
exactly.
My car has the heads up display on it. So when I'm driving, I never have to look down. Oh my God. I almost run out of gas because it's until I hear the ding, ding, ding. I never look down to see.
Yeah. Isn't that something? Yeah.
Sorry, Phil, you were going to say something?
Nothing of intelligence. Worry not. That's all being taken care of by Alex, all the intelligent parts. I'm doing the other parts. Alex, do people reach out to you on your website? And is that the best way for them to get a hold of you?
Yeah. Alex at alexshapiro.org is the email, and alexshapiro.org is the website. If you go to the .com, you'll get someone entirely different. And there are a lot of Alex Shapiros out there in the world. But anyway, .org. And people reach me there. It's great.
And they can approach you for pictures of all different kinds of whales.
All different kinds of whales and snakes. If they need snakes or whales, I'm their gal.
I heard another word for Python is megabyte.
Oh, now that's good. I like that. You're bringing tech and herpetology together in
and
one
the Python.
Fun.
Yeah, and the, see?
I like that.
Yeah. Really, really brilliant, Peter. Brilliant.
I'm pretty much as easily amused and entertained as pretty much any six-year-old. So this is working very well.
I'm loving very, it. Very well. I have a new audience in there actually yeah. laughing. This is beautiful.
Yeah. Know your audience. That's right.
That's right.
Alex. But what I want to flip this on you because I've been gabbing way too much. What are your views on as performers and people on the stage doing this? Well, in addition to whatever composing, but as performers, what are your views for what you see the future, even in the next 5 years, as being from your perspective with performance?
Peter and I are both, certainly performers to some degree, but what you're describing and how it relates to performing, I think, applies maybe even more to education. There's just no way we're going to be able to teach children effectively at any age, whether it be college, which we see every day, or, you know, my teenagers that I have at home and younger, if we don't adapt to the new brain, we're not going to be able to teach successfully. We're not going to be able to share a passion for music because we're not able to incorporate and access those students well. And as a performer, I'm really excited when I get a chance to play Alpine Symphony with Minnesota Orchestra. And there's a good crowd there, and it's usually close to full, but it is sold out 5 shows in a row when we're doing a movie. 5 shows in a row, and everybody's there. Now, that's a different type of popular contemporary entertainment. And it's more about the movie than it is the music. But it is a sign. It's a sign.
They can watch that movie without paying that ticket price. They can watch Lord of the Rings at home with a great sound system. There's something about being around live music. Like hearing the Minnesota Orchestra play that music is an experience worth the ticket.
But I think it ties into Alex's music, which is truly unique and original and genuine and honest and all the things that I compliment you on before, I hear them in your pieces. Mm-hmm. So it comes across, and everybody that I know that talks about your music feels the same way.
That's so incredibly kind and meaningful. Thank you.
Yeah. We were grateful that you spent an hour to talk with us. And
are you kidding? I need friends. I'm lonely. Hey, I'm on a rock in the middle of nowhere.
Oh,
you did
best.
Me a favor.
Oh, I think you got plenty to work on over there, but we're glad that you could sort of fool around with us for a little bit.
This was absolutely wonderful. Thank you so much for your time. It's great to see your studio. It's changed a lot. This is great.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank the two of you so much for inviting me into this fun space and virtual and heartfelt.
All right, Chris, good job. Even though you weren't here, and Phil, nice job preparing. Not so great on the intro there. You gave the humpback whale. I knew right away who this was. You got to be a little more elusive.
Yeah. C-minus intro. That's okay. I was too excited because she's like...
You were pretty engaged, yeah.
Yet another guest that's more intelligent than anyone interviewing her.
I mean, I had to go to snake jokes. I had nothing left. I was digging low.
Particularly,
that was something.
But we were able to avoid a number of Chris Gleasonisms.
We haven't said that word.
We have not said the dirty word.
And that might have to stay that way because you could still edit it in, but...
That'll be on him.
That's all.
It's on him. Absolutely.
And I'm excited to see Alex at Midwest. That will be fun.
It will be.
And I don't know how do we end this without Chris here?
No idea. How's that?
Beyond Artless is sponsored by Beyond the Notes Music Festival. Our mission is to create and provide profound learning and social experiences through music that go beyond the notes. Visit btnmusicfestival.com to learn more.
Artless.
What?
Artless. Beyond Artless.